2019, but that has not stopped Trump's expansionist ambitions from emerging as a major storyline days before he returns to the White House. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM. Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show. Today's show will obviously focus on what's happening in Syria. Basically, the fact that the Assad regime has fallen after a 10-year war, because people are dividing what has happened in the wake of the Arab Spring from what's happening now. And it is all connected. We're going to listen to somebody that has studied Syria for a while and had all the right positions during the Syrian civil war, although he was attacked as an Assadist, which he wasn't. Namely, this is Ben Norton that will be talking about it. One thing I wanted to say in terms of context for his presentation is that there's... obviously, this is a time, there are people who are outside of the country, for example, Arabs and others that have been supporting Palestine, that are worried about the future. But it's important to acknowledge the fact that thousands, maybe thousands of political prisoners are being released right now. There are many Syrians who are returning home and are celebrating, of course, the release of relatives and friends and folks from their towns and villages, etc. And that is not to be criticized, no matter what we think about what's going to replace the regime. This is a happy moment for these people. It's a genuine moment. And the horrors of the regime are being reported, but I'm not sure what extremes, and if these horrors existed back in during the Civil War, why did people have to make up stories about the use of chemical weapons, etc., when there are genuine horrors like these dungeons that are being reported, that where prisoners have been kept and hundreds have died, and kids were born in dungeons, in Assad's dungeons. So all of that is yet to be verified, but whether the most important thing right now in this moment is respecting the joy of liberation that the Syrians are feeling. But there's, as you will hear from Ben's report, which is very extensive about the history of this, we can't start the story secondly. The poet Barghouti, the Palestinian poet Barghouti, when you want to oppress people, you start the story secondly. And that context, that historical context that Ben provides, is really important to understand who is in charge now. And not only that, but the fact that Israel is been bombing Syria, and since the Syrian army has evaporated and Assad has left to take refuge in Russia, whatever they're bombing now, whether it's military or civilian, it belongs to the people of Syria. And so this is really an incursion on their sovereignty. And obviously, Israel and the United States, who have taken credit in helping overthrow Assad, they're not really interested in the Syrian people. And once the regime disappears, as happened in Iraq, as happened in Libya, it's not going to be a story. And what you're going to end up with is a Syria that's divided between Turkey, Israel, and the United States. And as I will hear, the United States, as usual, has control over the oil, the Syrian oil. So let's have a listen to this piece by Ben Norton that provides some historical context to what's happening right now.
After more than a decade of war fueled by foreign powers, the government of Syria has officially been overthrown, and the capital, Damascus, has been taken over by extremist rebels led by rebranded Al-Qaeda. This will have huge geopolitical repercussions. First of all, it is a major victory for the United States and Israel, which spent a decade supporting rebels in Syria, many of which were linked to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, spending billions of dollars arming and training these Al-Qaeda-linked rebels to try to overthrow the Syrian government, and they have succeeded. This is also a major blow to Iran, and it comes at a time when Israel, with U.S. support, is bombing and ethnically cleansing Gaza and committing genocide. It also comes at a time when Israel has invaded Lebanon and has killed much of the leadership of the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah. And now Israel is actually taking territory inside Syria and potentially could go even further and try to occupy more Syrian territory. So this is also a major loss for Iran. Syria was a major ally of Iran, and Syria had provided support and weapons to resistance groups in the region, in Palestine and Lebanon. And now Syria has been taken over by foreign-backed extremists who have repeatedly said, as I'll document today, that they want relations with Israel. They made it very clear in interviews with the Israeli media that they want to have good relations with Israel. And that's one of the reasons that they were allowed to come to power. So this is a significant loss for Iran. And this actually makes the possibility of a U.S.-Israeli war against Iran even more likely. It's also a major loss for Russia, which had supported Syria. But Russia was not able to send a lot of military support to Syria because it is fighting against NATO in a proxy war in Ukraine. So it's a loss for Iran and Russia. It's also a major win for Turkey, a member of NATO and a Western ally. Turkey's always playing both sides against each other, but at the end of the day, Turkey usually ends up siding with the US and the West and Israel. Although the leader of Turkey, President Erdogan, will claim to support the Palestinians, he has not actually provided any material support to the Palestinian resistance. He has not sent a single bullet or any weapons, unlike Iran and Syria, which have been supporting Palestinian resistance groups. Turkey, in fact, has also allowed oil to continue to flow to Israel. Therefore, Turkey, a member of NATO, is helping Israel carry out genocide in Gaza, while the International Criminal Court has officially issued an arrest warrant for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So that's the basic overview of what's happening geopolitically. Now I'm going to go into greater detail, and I'm going to provide detailed sources and citations for every fact that I mention. So now that Syria's longtime leader Bashar al-Assad has been overthrown, who will the next leader of Syria be? while the country is still in chaos, but the leader of the extremist rebels who took over Syria is the former chief of Al-Qaeda. His name is Abu Muhammad al-Julani, and the Western media has spent years whitewashing this literal Al-Qaeda leader and claiming that he has distanced himself from his extremist past and is now supposedly a moderate. CNN published an insane article titled, "How Syria's Rebel Leader Went from Radical Jihadist to a Blazer-Wearing Revolutionary." And they also show how Julani has changed his image, and it looks like he's been working with PR firms in the West, or maybe with the Gulf monarchies, you know, in Saudi Arabia or Qatar, which have been supporting these Salafi jihadist extremist rebels for years now. And they obviously told him to change his image. He actually dresses a lot like Zelensky in Ukraine, using this kind of green military garb. And he trimmed his beard a little bit. And now in his speeches, it's clear that he's been trained by public relations firms, because he's completely changed his rhetoric from just a few years ago, when literally he was the leader of Al-Qaeda in Syria. The Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria was previously called Jabhat al-Nusra, and it was the largest branch of Al-Qaeda in the world. And in 2017, it changed its name and rebranded initially as Jabhat Fatah Sham, which is part of a larger coalition. And then it rebranded again as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. And what's funny is when Al-Qaeda rebranded as HTS and claimed that it was no longer Al-Qaeda, even the U.S. Embassy in Syria released a statement making it clear that their position had not changed, that they still considered this to be a terrorist organization. The U.S. Embassy in Syria wrote in 2017, quote, "The core of HTS is Nusra, a designated terrorist org. This designation applies regardless of what name it uses or what groups merge into it. HTS is a merger, and any group that merges into it becomes part of Al-Qaeda's Syrian network. We remain committed to bringing leading Al-Qaeda and Syria figures in HTS to justice," end quote. That was the U.S. Embassy in Syria. And what's hilarious is that the U.S. Embassy published a wanted poster saying, "Stop this terrorist," with the face of Muhammad al-Julani, who is now the de facto leader of Syria and who was able to take power in Syria thanks to support from the West, from Israel, from the Gulf monarchies, and from Turkey. The Western media's whitewashing of the Syrian al-Qaeda leader reminds me of an article that was published in the major British newspaper The Independent back in 1993 that had a big photo of the future leader of Al-Qaeda in the entire world, Osama bin Laden. And the headline of the article was, quote, "Anti-Soviet warrior puts his army on the road to peace." And this article whitewashed Osama bin Laden, portraying him as a great anti-Soviet warrior who helped the West defeat the Soviet Union in the proxy war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, in which the CIA spent billions of dollars arming and training the original so-called moderate rebels, as the Western media called them, who were far-right Islamist extremists, fundamentalists, known as the Mujahideen. Well, Osama bin Laden was the leader of the Arab Mujahideen, who was attracting other extremists from around the world, who was using his wealth as a Saudi oligarch in order to fund this operation, this holy war against the Soviet Union in alliance with the CIA. And at that time, Osama bin Laden was an ally of the West in the US-led Cold War against the Soviet Union, just as today, rebranded Al-Qaeda in Syria is an ally of the West against the overthrown Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad and his allies, which were Iran and Russia and resistance groups like Hezbollah. And this was actually admitted by the current U.S. National Security Advisor in the Biden administration, Jake Sullivan. Back in 2012, Jake Sullivan was the top aide to then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And in 2012, Jake Sullivan sent Hillary Clinton an email in which he stated, quote, "AQ is on our side in Syria." Of course, AQ is Al-Qaeda. So he was saying, quote, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria, end quote. Those are the words of the current U.S. National Security Advisor, one of the most powerful foreign policy officials in the U.S. government, in the Biden administration, who admitted that for a decade, the United States has been allied with Al-Qaeda in Syria, just as the U.S. was allied with the precursors of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan in the 1980s. I published a separate article and video in which I talked about the history of the CIA program arming and training these extremist rebels in Syria. I will link to that in the description below. I cited an article published in the Washington Post in 2015 that admitted that the CIA had created this covert operation to arm and train so-called rebels in Syria, and that the CIA was spending nearly $1 billion per year. According to the Washington Post, CIA operations in Syria accounted for one out of every $15 in the CIA's budget, and this was the largest CIA covert operation since the CIA operation in Afghanistan in the 1980s that again gave birth to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The CIA program in Afghanistan was called Operation Cyclone, whereas the CIA program in Syria was called Operation Timber Sycamore. And just as the result of the CIA operation in Afghanistan in the 80s was the Taliban coming to power, and they're still in power today, the result of the CIA operation in Syria was rebranded Al-Qaeda coming to power in Syria. So the U.S. has its hands all over this. And what is especially insidious is seeing how the Western media has been whitewashing rebranded Al-Qaeda in Syria for years now, helping Al-Qaeda to carry out this rebranding operation, which is purely a marketing operation. When they said, we're no longer affiliated with Al-Qaeda, they still share the same extremist, fascist, Salafi jihadist ideology of Al-Qaeda. It was pure PR. We saw an example of this back in 2021 when the U.S. state media outlet PBS published a softball interview with al-Julani, the leader, former leader in scare quotes, former leader of Syrian Al-Qaeda. And he took off his traditional clothing and put on a Western suit. And this was the first time that a mainstream U.S. media outlet had published an interview with the leader of Syrian Al-Qaeda. And there was an incredible moment in this report done by PBS Frontline in which they interviewed the former U.S. diplomat James Jeffrey, who was the U.S. special representative for Syria. And he, in this interview, he referred to rebranded Al-Qaeda as a, quote, asset, end quote, for the U.S. strategy in Syria. So this is a top U.S. official referring to Al-Qaeda as an asset being used by the United States. He admitted it openly. Meanwhile, while the Western media was whitewashing Syrian Al-Qaeda, helping them try to rebrand, they were ruling in the northern Syrian province of Idlib, bordering Turkey with the support of NATO member Turkey. And literally 3 days after PBS published that softball interview whitewashing al-Julani, there are reports that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS, which Julani leads, rebranded Al-Qaeda, stoned 3 women to death in Idlib over accusations of adultery. So while the Western media was whitewashing rebranded Syrian Al-Qaeda, they were literally stoning women to death. This is the group that is now controlling the majority of Syria, excluding the East, which we'll talk about, which is militarily occupied by the United States. But most of Syria is governed by rebranded Al-Qaeda, which has been governing part of Syria for years now, the northern Idlib province. It was resorting to medieval-style extremist policies that it's now going to impose on major cities. And what this reminds me of is what happened in Libya in 2011 in North Africa. NATO led a war that destroyed the Libyan state, killing Libya's longtime leader, Muammar Gaddafi, and unleashing chaos. And still today, after more than 13 years, Libya has no central unified government. It's at a state of civil war. And there have been open-air slave markets. Some of the extremist Al-Qaeda-linked groups, Salafi jihadist fanatics, who were backed by NATO, backed by the US and France and Canada, they took over, these gangs took over parts of Libya, and they implemented some of these extremist medieval policies like HTS has done in Syria, and they created open-air slave markets enslaving sub-Saharan African refugees. So NATO literally helped bring chattel slavery back to Africa in its so-called liberation of Libya. And here we are today, and we see the same rhetoric, whereas in 2011, the Western media and Western government said, we liberated Libya. The so-called dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown. And meanwhile, life after Gaddafi has been exponentially worse, has been chaos and death and suffering and war. Meanwhile, Libya previously had the highest standard of living in the entire African continent. It had the highest rating of the Human Development Index. So unfortunately, I think what happened in Libya is very likely to be repeated now in Syria. And it breaks my heart to say this. I feel bad for the Syrian people, but we have to learn from history. Look what happened not only in 2011 in Libya, look what happened in Iraq in 2003. The U.S. invaded in a war of aggression. They overthrew Iraq's leader, Saddam Hussein, saying, we liberated the people of Iraq from their dictator. And what happened? Well, the U.S.-led war killed 1 million people in Iraq, devastating the country, destroying infrastructure, unleashing chaos. Still today, there are very high levels of violence in Iraq, and the U.S. troops never left. After 2 decades, there are still U.S. troops militarily occupying Iraq. And then, of course, it led to the rise of ISIS, along with the war in Syria. So the U.S., along with its allies like Israel and NATO member Turkey and the Gulf monarchies, they have been destabilizing this region for decades. Literally millions of people have died because of these U.S.-led wars. And now in Syria, after a decade of war, it looks like there's going to be even more instability and violence. But U.S. President Joe Biden is proud. And in a speech, he actually took credit for the overthrow of the Syrian government.
The upshot for all this is, for the first time ever, neither Russia nor Iran nor Hezbollah could defend this abhorrent regime in Syria. And this is a direct result of the blows that Ukraine, Israel have delivered upon their own self-defense with unflagging support of the United States. You know, over the past 4 years, my administration pursued a clear and principled policy towards Syria. First, we made clear from the start sanctions on Assad would remain in place unless he engaged seriously in a political process to end the civil war, as outlined by the UN Security Council resolution passed in 2015. But Assad refused, so we carried out a comprehensive sanction program against him and all those responsible for atrocities against the Syrian people. Second, we maintained our military presence in Syria. Third, we've supported Israel's freedom of action against Iranian networks in Syria and against actors aligned with Iran who transported lethal aid to Lebanon. And when necessary, ordered the use of military force against Iranian networks to protect U.S. forces. Our approach has shifted the balance of power in the Middle East.
So this is one of the major reasons that these extremist al-Qaeda-linked rebels were able to take over so much Syrian territory so quickly, because they had gotten tons of weapons from the U.S. and from its allies. In fact, back in 2015, the U.S. military publicly admitted that some of the weapons that it gave to the so-called moderate rebels were immediately given to al-Qaeda. And it's not just the U.S., Turkey also played a major role in supporting these extremist rebels. This was reported by the French media outlet AFP and the Israeli media outlet The Times of Israel. Opposition sources in Syria admitted that Turkish intelligence was helping them carry out this operation, and that Turkey itself, Erdogan, gave his green light to carry out this offensive to overthrow the Syrian government. Another country that was reportedly helping these al-Qaeda-linked rebels in Syria was Ukraine. This was reported in several Western media outlets because these extremist al-Qaeda-linked rebels in Syria were using suicide drones, kamikaze drones. And Syrian opposition figures told several media outlets that they were actually collaborating with Ukrainian intelligence, which was helping them coordinate to carry out this war. And Ukraine was also sharing some of this kamikaze drone technology that these Al-Qaeda-linked rebels were using to attack the Syrian army. And of course, Israel also played an important role in helping to overthrow the Syrian government. In fact, when these Al-Qaeda-linked rebels took over Damascus, the Israeli prime minister and wanted war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu, he visited the border with Syria for a photo op, and he published a speech in which he took credit for the overthrow of the Syrian government. Netanyahu boasted that the fall of Assad was, quote, a direct result of the blows we have inflicted on Iran and Hezbollah, the main supporters of the Assad regime, end quote. Here's that clip of Netanyahu.
This collapse is a direct result of our forceful action against Hezbollah and Iran, Assad's main supporters. It set off a chain reaction of all those who want to free themselves from this tyranny and its oppression.
Israel had been supporting these Syrian Al-Qaeda-linked rebels for years. Back in 2019, the chief of the IDF admitted that Israel had been giving weapons to the so-called rebels in Syria. The major Israeli media outlet, the Jerusalem Post, published an article admitting that Israel had been treating Syrian Al-Qaeda members in Israeli hospitals. So members of Al-Qaeda in Syria would cross over to Israel. Israel would treat them in its hospitals and then send them back into Syria to try to overthrow the Syrian government. Well, now they've succeeded, and Syrian rebranded Al-Qaeda is in power in Syria in no small part thanks to the support it got from Israel. The U.S. media has openly boasted that Israel helped to overthrow the Syrian government. The neoconservative New York Times columnist Brett Stevens, who has enthusiastically supported every single U.S. war. He's a complete hawk. He loved the war in Iraq. And he published a column at the New York Times titled, "Syrians also have Israel to thank for their liberation," end quote. So they're not even hiding it. And this December, the Times of Israel published several different articles that feature interviews with members of the Al-Qaeda-linked Syrian opposition who said that they love Israel. I'm not exaggerating. One of these Syrian rebels said, quote, "We love Israel and we were never its enemies. We don't hate you. We love you very much," end quote. They're saying that as Israel is carrying out genocide in Gaza and ethnic cleansing and killing tens of thousands of Palestinian children. This is what the Syrian opposition says because they were backed by Israel. The Times of Israel published another article in December interviewing a Syrian rebel commander from the so-called Free Syrian Army, which was partially created by the CIA, backed by the US, backed by Turkey. And he said very clearly that they wanted to establish formal diplomatic relations with Israel. They asked for more support from Israel to fight against Iran. In this article, the Syrian rebel commander thanked Israel for attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon and said that that helped them. It prevented Hezbollah in Lebanon from going into Syria, from supporting the Syrian government and fighting against these Al-Qaeda, rebranded Al-Qaeda-led rebels. And by dividing Lebanon and Syria, and because Russia was also bogged down in Ukraine, this isolated Syria and is what allowed rebranded Al-Qaeda to take over the country. And now Israel is taking advantage of the situation and trying to seize more territory inside Syria. Immediately after rebranded Al-Qaeda took power in Damascus, Israel sent troops into the buffer zone surrounding the illegally occupied Golan Heights. Now, according to international law, Golan Heights is part of Syrian territory, but Israel has illegally occupied it since 1967. And in 1974, there was an agreement reached on a buffer zone, and Israel did not enter that buffer zone for 50 years. The Syrian government prevented Israel from taking more territory. But as soon as rebranded Al-Qaeda took over in Syria, Israel went into the buffer zone, seizing more Syrian territory. And now many people suspect that Israel may try to colonize even more Syrian land, just as Israel has tried to colonize southern Lebanon. So there's no way around it. It has to be said that this is a huge blow to the axis of resistance in the Middle East, in West Asia. This is a major blow that has done severe damage to these resistance groups fighting against Israeli colonialism, because Syria had been a major support of weapons, Hezbollah, resistance groups in Palestine. And also it was a land bridge. Physically, it was a land bridge from Iran into Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, and then into Palestine. And now by removing Syria from the heart of the resistance axis, this is going to be very damaging. It's not the end of the resistance axis. Israel wants people to believe that. They have done damage to these groups. They've killed the leadership of Hezbollah. They've done a lot of damage to Hamas. They've helped to overthrow the Syrian government. But there still are many resistance groups. Iran is still going to continue to support resistance against Israeli colonialism and U.S. imperialism. In Iraq, there are resistance groups. Hezbollah in Lebanon has not been defeated. Some of its leaders have been killed, but it still remains intact and has been able to successfully fight against the Israeli colonial occupiers trying to colonize more Lebanese territory. Also in Yemen, the resistance Ansar Allah, known as the Houthis, but the official name is Ansar Allah, they are still the de facto government in northern Yemen in the capital Sana'a, and they have continued providing support to the Palestinian people. So the axis of resistance is not entirely defeated, but this is a major setback. It is a significant blow to the resistance. Decisively won the war, but they have decisively won a strategic battle. So what is going to happen in Syria? What is Syria going to look like? It's, of course, impossible to predict, but I should say that there is still a big question mark about whether or not Syria as a state in its territorial integrity will remain intact. Is Israel occupying the Golan Heights and potentially expanding to take more territory? Not only does NATO member Turkey have de facto control over several northern parts in Syria, and Turkey may try to colonize and take that land as well, but there's also another huge factor, which is the eastern part of Syria. Now, I'm looking at a map here from Al Jazeera, which is a little out of date because the overthrow of the Syrian government happened so quickly. But if you look at a map, you can see that the Al-Qaeda, rebranded Al-Qaeda-led so-called rebels, have taken control of most of the western part of Syria, including the biggest cities of Damascus and Aleppo. However, in the eastern part of Syria, there are Kurdish-led militias known as the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, within which one of the main Kurdish-led groups is the YPG and the YPJ. And they still have a de facto government in the eastern part of Syria. And the U.S. military has been helping to occupy this land. And by the way, it's not a coincidence that this just so happens to be the land where a majority of Syria's oil fields are located. So the U.S. and these Kurdish-led groups have been occupying Syria's oil fields, and they were preventing the Syrian government from getting access to revenue from this oil. In fact, when Donald Trump was president in his first term, he boasted in an interview on Fox News that he left U.S. troops in Syria in order to take the oil. He repeated that like 20 times. Listen.
And then they'd say he left troops in Syria. You know what I did? I left troops to take the oil. I took the oil. The only troops I have are taking the oil. They're protecting the oil. I took
right,
over
we're taking the oil. We're not taking
well,
the oil.
Well, maybe we will. Maybe we won't.
They're protecting the facility.
I don't know. Maybe we should take it. But we have the oil right now. The United States has the oil. So they say he left troops in Syria. No, I got rid of all of them other than we're protecting the oil. We have the oil.
And to be fair, it's not just Trump. This U.S. neocolonial occupation of Syria's oil-rich territory is bipartisan in the U.S. government. I did another article and video about this that I will link to in the description below. Looking at a vote that was held in the U.S. Senate in 2023, this was on a bill that called for the U.S. military to withdraw from Syria. And what was the vote? 84 of the 100 members of the Senate voted against it. That is in defense of the neocolonial U.S. military occupation of Syria, and that included many Republicans and Democrats. Only 13 members of the Senate voted to actually withdraw these U.S. troops. And by the way, this partially provides an answer to the question many people have. Why did the Syrian government fall so quickly? It seemed like it happened out of nowhere. Well, it's because in reality, the Syrian government was very weak, not only after a decade of war fueled by the U.S. and Israel and Turkey and the Gulf states, not only because of the destruction, the physical destruction of the war, but also because economically, the Syrian government was suffering very significantly due to the Western sanctions on it and due to the theft of oil. So previously, the Syrian government had used some of that oil revenue in order to get access to foreign currencies to pay for imports. Now, Syria was never a major oil producer like Saudi Arabia or Iran, but it needed those oil exports to get access to foreign currency, to stabilize its own currency, to bring down inflation, to import technology and medicine. But because it was starved of oil revenue, it was also starved of foreign currency, which caused significant inflation issues. And this became much worse in 2019 when the US and Europe imposed suffocating sanctions on Syria. In the US, this was known as the Caesar Act, which was the bill passed, the law that imposed these devastating sanctions that completely crushed the Syrian economy. And in fact, in 2022, the top UN expert on sanctions, the UN Special Rapporteur Alina Duhan, published a very important report that detailed how these Western sanctions, which violate international law, by the way, because they're unilateral, so they're illegal. She detailed how they suffocated the people of Syria. That was her word, suffocated the people of Syria. I'm reading here from the report published by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. This report, again, is by the UN Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures and Human Rights, Alina Duhan. She said that the Western unilateral sanctions against Syria were, quote, exacerbating the destruction and trauma suffered by the Syrian people, end quote. It resulted in the, quote, total economic and financial isolation of a country whose people are struggling to rebuild a life with dignity following the decade-long war, end quote. She talked about the, quote, catastrophic effects of unilateral sanctions across all walks of life in the country, end quote. She said 90% of Syria's population was living below the poverty line with limited access to food, water, electricity, shelter, cooking, heating fuel, transportation, and healthcare. She said, quote, more than half of the vital infrastructure is either completely destroyed or severely damaged. She added that the imposition of unilateral sanctions, quote, quashed national income and undermine efforts toward economic recovery and reconstruction, end quote. And the sanctions also blocked international payments. It meant that foreign companies didn't want to do trade with Syria, which prevented Syria from importing medicines and food and fuel. It blocked access to foreign currencies. It cut off access to foreign banks and finance. So in other words, the Western powers have been economically suffocating Syria for years under a medieval siege, essentially. And they succeeded ultimately in this economic war. They basically collapsed the Syrian state. They eroded the Syrian state's capabilities of providing infrastructure and security and healthcare and maintaining monetary stability. It's not a coincidence that after the US and EU imposed these Caesar sanctions on Syria in 2019, inflation spiraled out of control. And then, of course, there was also the pandemic. So, I mean, economically, it was a disaster what was happening in Syria. In 2021, inflation hit over 180%. And still today, inflation is around 120%. So the economy is in free fall. The Western powers have been suffocating it. And now rebranded Al-Qaeda has taken power. And if you think that there was economic mismanagement before under the Assad government, imagine what the economy is going to look like under a bunch of extremist Salafi jihadist fanatic warlords who have no idea how to run an economy, yet alone a modern state. So this is why it's so important to push back against these simplistic explanations you hear from Western pundits saying that the Syrian government fell because Assad was a horrible, brutal dictator and everyone hated him and blah, 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 and it was a disaster. I mean, if you think corruption was bad previously, what do you think it's going to look like now under rebranded Al-Qaeda? And people who talk about the economic mismanagement and corruption who don't mention these sanctions and the Western siege and suffocation of the Syrian people and the attempt to implode their economy and the fact that Syria was unable to import, not only because foreign companies didn't want to do business with Syria because it's sanctioned, not only because Syrian banks were cut off from international finance, but also because the U.S. military was occupying Syria's oil fields, preventing Syria from exporting oil and getting access to foreign revenue. This is not about authoritarianism or democracy and all of those propaganda buzzwords used in the West. Every single government in West Asia is authoritarian. There are no liberal democracies. Of course, Israel is a genocidal apartheid regime, colonial regime, carrying out genocide in Gaza, attacking all of its neighbors. It's not in any way a democracy. Palestinian people have no rights whatsoever. Lebanon is more democratic than Israel, but Lebanon as a state has been destroyed by the U.S. and Israel. Lebanon is a failed state thanks to them. Syria has been overthrown. Iraq is a complete disaster as well after, you know, the U.S. has been waging war there and still militarily occupying it. You have Turkey, which is not a democracy. You know, Erdogan is an authoritarian leader. And the Gulf monarchies, give me a break. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, they are hereditary dictatorships. They are monarchies. Jordan is a dictatorship. It's, of course, an obedient U.S. puppet. Jordan is run by a dictator, a king, a hereditary monarch, but it is not in any way a democracy. So all this obsession with Syria and democracy and authoritarianism is infantile. It has nothing to do with what is actually happening politically in the country, which is that the U.S. for over a decade led an imperialist proxy war to collapse the Syrian state, and they succeeded. And now rebranded Al-Qaeda is in power. They got what they wanted. The U.S. government had a very clear strategy to try to collapse the Syrian state. This was spelled out very clearly by the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, Dana Struhl, who was a top official at the Defense Department. She outlined four main parts of the U.S. strategy to collapse the Syrian state. First of all, the U.S. military occupation of one-third of Syrian territory, which she said the U.S. military owned, like it was the U.S. Empire's colonial property. And then the U.S. military used that resource-rich economic powerhouse to starve the Syrian government of revenue. Level two of the strategy was diplomatically to isolate the Syrian government, which they succeeded in doing. Three, it was brutal economic sanctions to crush the Syrian economy, which succeeded. And part four, as she said very clearly, was to prevent reconstruction aid and technical expertise from going into Syria, to prevent Syria from rebuilding, which meant that the people of Syria were living in rubble. Their lives were still hell, and the U.S. was trying to prevent the Syrian people from having a good life. Listen to her lay out the strategy very clearly back in 2019.
The United States still had compelling forms of leverage on the table to shape an outcome that was more conducive and protective of U.S. interests. And we identified four. So the first one was the one-third of Syrian territory that was owned via the U.S. military with its local partner, the Syrian Democratic Forces. Now, this was a light footprint on the U.S. military, only about 1,000 troops over the course of the Syria Study Group's report. And then the tens of thousands of forces, both Kurdish and Arab, under the Syrian Democratic Forces. And that one-third of Syria is the resource-rich, it's the economic powerhouse of Syria. So where the hydrocarbons are, which obviously is very much in the public debate here in Washington these days, as well as the agricultural powerhouse. But we argued that it wasn't just about this one third of Syrian territory that the U.S. military and our military presence owned, both to fight ISIS and also as leverage for affecting the overall political process for the broader Syrian conflict. There were three other areas of leverage. One is political and diplomatic isolation of the Assad regime. So holding the line on diplomatic isolation, preventing embassies from going back into Damascus. Two is the economic sanctions architecture. So some of this is part of the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration on Iran, but there's a whole suite of both executive and congressional sanctions on Syria and Bashar al-Assad, both for human rights abuses in Syria and to the backers of Assad for their activities on support in support of him in Syria. And three was reconstruction aid. So the United States remains the overall largest single donor of humanitarian aid to Syrians both inside Syria and refugees outside of Syria. And there was some stabilization assistance in the part of Syria that was liberated from ISIS and controlled via the Syrian Democratic Forces in northern eastern Syria. The rest of Syria, though, is rubble. And what the Russians want and what Assad wants is economic reconstruction. And that is something that the United States can basically hold a card on via the international financial institutions and our cooperation with the Europeans. So we argue that absent behavioral changes by the Assad regime, we should hold the line on preventing reconstruction aid and technical expertise from going back into Syria.
So with all of that said, before we conclude, there are still two more important questions that I want to try to answer. The first is, what will Syria look like territorially in the future? Will Syria as a unified state remain in power? Well, given that the U.S. military is still maintaining a kind of neo-colonial occupation of the eastern part of Syria, it seems possible that the U.S. will try to break up Syrian territory and create potentially a new country or new regions that are essentially a new country. And this has been a goal of U.S. imperial strategists for years. I'm looking at a map here that was created by the neoconservative former U.S. military officer Ralph Peters, who was a hardline war hawk, and he created this map that shows a U.S. recreation of the Middle East, of West Asia. And part of that involves breaking up Syria. He also wanted to break up Iraq, and the U.S., at least these U.S. imperial strategists, want to try to break off part of Iran in order to create a Kurdistan, to create a separate country that would include part of eastern Syria. And we also know now that Israel is trying to colonize more Syrian territory as well. So it's possible that the U.S. and its allies in the region may try to carve up Syria and break it up as we know it today. It will no longer, I think there still will be a country that is called Syria, but the map will probably look different. And then there's also Turkey. Turkey is already controlling part of northern Syria, and there's a possibility that Turkey may also try to colonize part of northern Syria. And finally, this brings me to Iran. The last note I want to end with is what this could mean for Iran. Well, honestly, it's very bad news for Iran. Iran has lost one of its most important allies in the region. It's very possible that Israel may try to go deeper into Syria. The U.S. is already controlling part of the eastern part of Syria. And Iran has always been at the top of the list for the U.S. and Israel for a regime change war. And this was revealed by the former U.S. general and NATO commander, Wesley Clark. This was one of the former top officials in the U.S. military, and he famously revealed that after 9/11, the Pentagon had created plans in order to overthrow the governments of seven countries. What were those countries? Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. Here is this very important clip.
Right after 9/11, about 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got a come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second. I said, well, you're too busy. He said, no. He says, we've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq. This was on or about the 20th of September. So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk. He picked up a piece of paper. And he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Now, obviously, as he said, the U.S. was planning on trying to overthrow all of these governments in 5 years. They did not succeed in 5 years, but they've succeeded in 2 decades. If you look at that list, 6 of those 7 governments have been overthrown in U.S.-backed regime change operations and wars. The U.S. invaded Iraq and overthrew its government in 2003. The Syrian government has now been overthrown. Lebanon is a complete failed state that is currently being invaded by Israel. Somalia was invaded by Ethiopia with the support of the U.S. in 2006, and Somalia has basically been a failed state since then. Libya's government was overthrown by NATO in 2011 and has been a failed state. Sudan's government was overthrown in 2019, and Sudan is in a horrible state of civil war. And now the only government remaining on that list is Iran. So this leads us to the question, is this the moment when the U.S. and Israel launch a full-scale war on Iran, especially with Donald Trump coming back to the White House? Trump tore up the Iran nuclear deal. He was an extreme hawk against Iran. He carried out a maximum pressure strategy to try to collapse the Iranian government. And if you look at Trump's cabinet, at least his nominees to be Secretary of State, it's another neoconservative hawk, Marco Rubio, who wants to overthrow the Iranian government. Donald Trump's nominee to be National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, is another neocon hawk who wants to overthrow the Iranian government. His Defense Secretary nominee, who may potentially not be actually appointed, but he is Pete Hegseth, another neoconservative hawk. The point is that pretty much everyone in Trump's cabinet is a hawk who wants to overthrow the Iranian government. So is this the moment in which the war hawks in Washington have fantasized for decades about overthrowing the Iranian government, having a war on Iran? Well, now that they have weakened the resistance axis, overthrown the Syrian government, devastated the Palestinian resistance, done serious damage to Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance, will they go after Iran? Well, of course, we won't know what's going to happen in the future, but I think this is a very important issue that we should be keeping our eye on. And this is one of the very significant consequences of the overthrow of the Syrian government. Like I said, geopolitically, there's no other way of putting it. This is a major victory for the U.S. and Israel as part of their attempt to try to recolonize West Asia to advance the interests of the U.S. empire. But on that note, I'm going to conclude. I've already said enough. This was a pretty long analysis. I do want to thank everyone for joining me today. I'm Ben Norton. I'm the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. Please like and subscribe. Please share this. I will be back soon for much more analysis and reporting. Thanks, everyone, again. I will see you all next time.
What do Angela Davis, Mehdi Hasan, Ibrahim X. Kendi, V, formerly Eve Ensler, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Sonia Sanchez, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, Mosab Abu Toha, Congresswoman Cori Bush, Noura Erekat, Congressman Jamal Bowman, Farafina Khan, Linda Sarsour, Isra Shakir, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and WPFW have in common? Well, Busboys and Poets 2025 Peace Ball, Voices of Justice and Liberation, an event featuring live music, speeches, performances, food, and drink. Details, including a complete list of speakers and performers, as well as how you can both support WPFW and join the fun on Saturday, January 18th, 8 p.m. at Arena Stage's Meade Center for American Theater, can be found at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
I just wanna thank you, yeah. I should.
Happy New Year. This is Miyuki, Interim General Manager. As we close out this incredible 2024, we want to take a moment to thank you. Your support, passion, and belief in WPFW's mission have made 2024 possible. You sustain WPFW, you help fortify WPFW from malicious unknowns, and you ensure WPFW could transition to a new studio where broadcasting has been uninterrupted. Together, we've celebrated the music and the stories. Together, we've presented the voices often unheard and have provided much-needed insights. Here's to you, our listeners, volunteers, and supporters, for making this all possible. Thank you from all of us, WPFW. Together, we will build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, January 8th. Here are some headlines. At least two people were killed as a trio of fast-growing wildfires raged out of control today near Los Angeles, destroying hundreds of buildings, scorching hillsides, and prompting officials to order some 70,000 people to evacuate their homes. By early today, more than 5,600 acres of Los Angeles County had burned. The Palisades fire had burned over 3,000 acres and destroyed homes and businesses. Dozens of drivers abandoned their cars on Tuesday, as some chose to flee the flames on foot. The Eaton Fire near Pasadena is quickly increasing in size today amid dangerous high winds. California's governor is urging residents to heed the evacuation warnings that extend from Malibu to Santa Monica. Energy providers have begun shutting off power in high-risk areas to prevent damaged infrastructure from igniting more blazes. In other news, in an emergency application filed late yesterday, President-elect Donald Trump urged the U.S. Supreme Court to pause sentencing in his New York hush money case, which is set for Friday. Trump's emergency appeal arrived a day after a state appeals court in New York rejected his request to postpone the sentencing. Trump's emergency application asked the Supreme Court to prevent the prosecution until his appeals implicating presidential immunity are resolved. Trump argues that he is entitled to full immunity from prosecution and even sentencing now that he is president-elect. Mr. Trump's lawyers argued in the Supreme Court filing that being officially deemed a felon might complicate Donald Trump's presidential duties. And in Minneapolis, city leaders agreed Monday to a police accountability plan with the Justice Department that mandates extensive charges aimed at curbing excessive force and racial discrimination more than 4.5 years after the police killing of George Floyd led to nationwide protests. The legally binding consent decree marks a victory for the Biden administration in its efforts to use federal power to require local police departments to pursue broad changes. Under Attorney General Merrick Garland, the Justice Department has opened a dozen pattern or practice civil investigations into state or local law enforcement agencies. Minneapolis is the second jurisdiction to enter a consent agreement after Louisville last month. And Greenland may become independent if its residents want, but is unlikely to become a U.S. state, Denmark's foreign minister said today, after U.S. President-elect Donald Trump said he might take over the mineral-rich and strategically important island by force. Speaking to the press, Trump would not rule out using the military to acquire control of the Panama Canal and Greenland, as he discussed his second-term agenda. Additionally, Trump said he could use economic force to turn Canada into the United States' 51st state, and floated the idea of renaming the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. Officials in Denmark and Greenland have reportedly said the island is not for sale, dating back to when Trump first floated the idea in 2009.